support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the island of Oahu. Right now we're with Thomas Fargo, who's a retired admiral in the United States Navy.
Tom, it's good to have you out here in Hawaii.
I hope you don't mind diverting and going back in time. So curious about people like you that we might have even gone to high school together. And you probably had no clue that you'd wake up one day and be an admiral in the Navy. How did your journey start?
It's interesting that, you know, I came from a Navy family, a long-standing Navy family. My father was a naval aviator. He actually flew P-2Vs originally and then was a test pilot and flew A-3s. He actually died in service when I was in the second grade. My mom was a Navy nurse in World War II. She went to Cal, went to Stanford Nursing School, and then she signed up and actually spent quite a bit of time in the Western Pacific in places like Guadalcanal.
Did they talk much about their World War II experiences with you?
A little bit. After my father was killed, my mother remarried 3 years later to another naval officer, Bill Fargo, who was a brave guy because he adopted the three kids, and that's how I became Tom Fargo. And he, of course, had seen a lot of action in World War II. He was on the battleship Arizona, coming right out of the Naval Academy, spent about a year on the Arizona, and then he got orders to new construction for the new construction battleship USS Washington. So he spent the entire war on the USS Washington, started out as an ensign, and left as a lieutenant commander when the war was over. But they saw action in almost all of the major battles in the Pacific, including around Guadalcanal, Sabo Island, really an extensive amount of time. And he didn't really talk about it much until you poked and probed a little bit, like many in that generation.
So I imagine the Arizona was really poignant and close to his heart.
Well, it was. It was his first ship. And when I used to talk to him about his classmates, you know, that graduated with him at the same time in the class of 39, they almost all went to battleship. Most of those folks came right out of the Naval Academy, went to a battleship, and spent the war on one of those ships. Now, some may have later become naval aviators and so on, but that's how they all started. And, of course, at that point in time, the battleships were very clearly the centerpiece of our naval power.
Talk to us about the story of transitioning from, you were probably in college, were you ROTC, and how did you go active?
No, I went to the Naval Academy.
You did.
As I said, my father and my stepfather had gone to the Naval Academy. We actually were stationed at the Naval Academy when I was just starting, really, elementary school. But I had an immediate affinity for it, and I made a determination early on that I wanted to go to the Naval Academy, and I was fortunate to be able to do so. So I had that background. Like most people at the Naval Academy, you always think that you're going to be a pilot. You've seen the Blue Angels, and as I said, my father was a pilot. But I went and went down and immediately flunked the eye physical. I think I was 20, 35, and I kept reading the charts. And the guy said, quit squinting. And I said, I'm not squinting. And when he held my eyes open, it was pretty clear I was going to have to find something else to do. And so I looked around, and this is 1969, and it looked to me like the submarine force and the center of the Cold War. The Soviets had built a very capable submarine force, and that looked to be one of the places that would be really an exciting place to spend my career.
So you went immediately shipboard as a submariner then?
Yeah, there's a little training we had to go through first. You know, as usual, there's nuclear power training and submarine training that are a part of the prerequisites before you go to your first submarine. But about 18 months after I was commissioned, I was on my first submarine, the USS Gannard in San Diego.
How did you evolve? How did you wake up one day an admiral? I mean, that's incredible.
Well, I think one job at a time is the way you do it. I can remember the early days, I was just hoping to make a lieutenant. And I don't think anybody, you know, at that point in time in your career ever says, you know, I'm going to be an admiral, at least not the people that probably end up being fortunate and being selected to flag rank. But, you know, I had a great career in the submarine force. I enjoyed it tremendously. As I said, it was right at the height of the Cold War, so it was exciting and rewarding. And I also had a number of opportunities to get to Washington, D.C. As a matter of fact, I ended up having 5 tours of duty in Washington, D.C. I'd go to Washington, and I guess had some success, and that would allow me to go back to sea into the next job, and then you'd rotate back to Washington again. I worked for some fabulous leaders and, frankly, was very fortunate.
So when did you go to work out the Pacific Fleet, and what did you do, and why did they bring you out here?
Well, I was actually stationed in Washington at the time as the director of operations and plans for the Navy. Once again, I was very fortunate, and the leadership of the Navy decided to make me a 4-star admiral, and my assignment was as commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet.
Oh, amazing. So when you started out, when you went active duty, there were still guys that were active who served in World War II, correct?
Certainly, yeah.
So you layer that you interacted and worked with guys who served in World War II. And now you're out here at Pearl Harbor in the Pacific. So you had this double layer of palpable affinity and closeness to the World War II era and what happened here at Pearl Harbor.
Well, I think one of the things you have to understand, I spent almost my entire career in the Pacific with the exception of the shore duty tours in Washington, D.C. So, you know, World War II and the Pacific are so closely entwined in terms of the history that at every turn you had a flavor for the kinds of, for example, amphibious operations that occurred across the Pacific. As you traveled through the Pacific, you would see all of these different historical sites, whether it's Tarawa and Peleliu or Iwo Jima, you know, that a huge part of our history. And I would tell you, the first day I walked into my quarters in October of 1999, that house was the same house that Admiral Nimitz occupied and lived in throughout World War II. And right on the desk as you walked in to those quarters was his autobiography. And so you can imagine the first thing that you read that first week in the job, if you hadn't already, was Nimitz's autobiography. So you can't travel anywhere in Hawaii or the Western Pacific where you aren't constantly reminded of this very important part of our nation's history.
It is fascinating how there is even that palpable visual symbolic legacy that lives on the structures, Ford Island, the Pearl Harbor itself, in many ways very unchanged since World War II.
No, that's absolutely true. You see it, and you're going to see a lot of it during your visit here. But it's also the lessons of World War II. I mean, when you walk into Nimitz's home, or you walk into his old headquarters down at Pearl Harbor, I mean, you have to think, you know, what it was like. You know, 10 days after the attack, when President Roosevelt gave him his orders to go to Hawaii, to go to Pearl Harbor, and take command of what was a fleet that had been devastated by those attacks. And I remember reading some of what he wrote about that period of time, and he said very clearly, you know, the first 2 months after he took command, things only got worse. You know, it was a very confusing and chaotic period of time as the Japanese appeared to actually make further gains after Pearl Harbor. And it wasn't really until, you know, Coral Sea and then especially Midway in June of 1942 where the tide started to turn.
And if you think about it, Midway, there was some luck involved.
There's a lot of luck involved. As you know, they were very fortunate to catch the Japanese and in a situation where they were rearming. It could have come out differently, but I think leadership at that point in time recognized that they had to take, you know, a measured risk if they were going to turn this thing around. But, you know, there were lots of lessons from that period of time. As a submariner, one of the lessons, and you see it in some of the movies made about Pearl Harbor, you know, the submarine force had a torpedo problem. And you've probably seen it, you know, the scenes where torpedoes were bouncing off the hulls of Japanese ships because the fuses weren't detonating. And, you know, those kinds of lessons were things that stuck with us throughout our careers. I can remember my boss, who was the head of the submarine force at the time, you know, when we were bringing on the new Mark 48 torpedo, you know, said, I'm not going to be the guy that introduces a set of torpedoes that have problems like we did in World War II. So the lessons of World War II are something that are inculcated in you from the early days at the Naval Academy and throughout your career. As we know, we lost some 2,000 service members during the attack, but there were another 400 folks, you know, some of which were civilian, that died on December 7th.
On base employees.
Yeah, 1941. And, of course, it impacted this community directly for the next 4.5 years, but really for their entire lives. You know, you and I were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, this place was blacked out afterwards. And it was a very abrupt change because if you looked at the country right before the attack on Pearl Harbor, it was one of essentially isolationist sentiments. I mean, you look at the video of, you know, folks down in Waikiki, and it was a pretty good time, you know, for America in advance of that. We'd come out of the Depression, the economy was picking up, and nobody really wanted to get involved in another world war. You know, there were a lot of rumors. We just moved the Pacific Fleet from the West Coast out to Hawaii. But I think the general sentiment was that if there was an attack by the Japanese, it would probably be in the Far East somewhere, you know, probably someplace like the Philippines. So this was a shock, and it changed people's lives abruptly, not just for a very short period of time, those 90 minutes where that attack occurred, but their lives going forward.
Well, even the nuances, that perfect storm Sunday morning, I mean, that's seminal. It would have been different, a different dynamic. It was Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, maybe. You know, metaphorically, you're right. You know, people always say, well, it happened at 7:55, so probably the sailors were asleep, or they were all on liberty. Well, that wasn't the case. You know, reveille goes off 7 days a week on those Navy ships, and so you know, most people were up and about. But it was Sunday, and it was there were a lot of people ashore, you know, on leave or liberty or in their homes, and so it was a quiet time, you know, relatively when that attack occurred.
Thomas Fargo, Admiral, United States Navy, retired. What an absolute honor and a true pleasure to spend the afternoon with you.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's been a great pleasure for me to get a chance to talk to you and understand that you're out here doing the kinds of things that I think are really important. I mean, you're going to visit all these historic sites, talk to the historians, the people that, you know, are making sure this fabulous history of our nation is properly preserved and projected to all those folks, both Americans and international community, because it's hugely important.
I'm Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Thomas Fargo, Admiral, United States Navy, retired on the island of Oahu, Hawaii.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolfe, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.